Welcome. I'm Emily Thorne. I'm going to be the moderator for today, and thank you for attending session 163, titled Waiting for Morning, The Poetry of Robert Rees. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation, after it ends at the registration desk here on the main floor. We encourage you also to purchase other Sunstone merchandise or to make a donation to Sunstone to help support these amazing events. Additionally, this isn't in my little script, but please silence your cell phones. I am a classical singer, and inevitably, in every concert, somebody's phone goes off, and we all talk about it backstage, and we do talk badly about you. So,
someone has actually written a symphony for instruments and cell phones. And at a certain this is true. And at a certain point, the conductor asks everybody to take out their cell phone and turn on their music, and they play for a period of time, and then it goes back in to the symphony. That's a good way.
Fantastic. It's perfect. So please do silence your cell phones. This session, is 60 minutes long, and we ask both the audience and the presenters to keep within the framework. A little about this presentation. This session is devoted to a reading from Bob Rees's newly published collection of poems, Waiting for Morning. In his foreword to the collection, Clifton Jolly observes, "The miracle of Bob's optimism is not only that it is, but that it is in spite of the world, in spite of evidence to the contrary, in spite of what we cannot justify or explain. Because Bob is certain that in spite of everything, there is hope and faith and, most of all, love." Bob Rees, former chair of the Sunstone Board of Directors, has published poetry in a number of journals, magazines, and anthologies. As a professor of literature, his favorite course is Introduction to Poetry. We will turn the time over to Bob. Please welcome Bob Rees.
This could seem like an exercise in vanity, and I assure you that it's not. There's precedence for this, and that was my dear friend Mary Bradford, who is a wonderful poet, maybe 10 years ago published a collection of her poems called Purple, and she said, why don't we do a Sunstone session in which people come together and read my poems? And we loved it. It was wonderful. And so when my anthology was published, someone said, "Why don't you do what Mary did?" And I thought, that's a good idea. We'll have people come together and we'll just have a session of reading poetry, because after all, even though poetry doesn't make anything happen, the world also can't live without it, or certainly one could say the world is made much better by it. And so today this is an invitation for anyone who wants to read. And do you need a copy? There's some more there. Okay. And here come a couple more people, and I've got more of those. Okay.
Bob, if you want, I can be in charge of it.
I'll make you the keeper. Oh, there we go. And there are. So we'll wait till everybody gets a copy of the poem. We'll have two microphones so people can. Oh, here's. If you care to buy it, the book is normally 13 something. You can have it for $10, but I don't think people care to change anymore. And we won't worry about that right now. because we want to spend some time talking about poetry. I'm sorry, Clifton Jolly isn't here. Clifton wrote the introduction to this collection of poetry, and Bob Christmas, one of our fellow poets, read my collection of poems and read Clifton's introduction. He said Clifton's introduction is much better than Bob's poetry. And so I'm sorry Clifton isn't here to hear that. He should have been here because he was going to be reading it, but obviously be called to other things. I mentioned something about the necessity of poetry. What people don't seem to remember or understand is that God speaks in poetry. 60% of the Old Testament is poetry. I'm told by poets that the 2/3 of the Book of Mormon, which is sealed, is all poetry. We at least like to think that. And Jesus spoke in poetry, as does Joseph Smith. We don't have very many people at 47 East South Temple speaking in poems, but we have a number of poets in the church, and I would highly recommend, if you haven't seen it, Dove Song, a collection of poems about Heavenly Mother put together by a group of Latter-day Saints. You can buy copies of it out here, and there's some wonderful poems that really expand the dimensions and the mysteries and the character of our Heavenly Mother, so if you can read that. One of the reasons we need poetry is that we tend, the opposite of poetry is a tendency toward literalism. And in the church, we have a problem with a kind of fundamentalist literalism. And I like to tell people there is no such thing as a biblical literalist. Absolutely. Anyone who wants to tell me he or she is a biblical literalist, I will prove to them within a sentence or two that they can't be. Because so much of the scriptures, in fact, are metaphorical, are full of wonderful images that expand our understanding. I think the reason God speaks to us in poetry is that we can't all say, this is what it means, although we have a tendency to say, this is what it means. But God is trying to say, no, keep the possibilities open. And poetry keeps the possibilities open. So one of the things we have in the church are people who, as in Billy Collins has written a poem called Introduction to Poetry. And it reminds me sometimes of my experience in gospel doctrine class. And this is the poem. I ask them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide, or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse into the poem and watch him probe his way out, or walk inside the poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore. But all they really want to do is tie the poem to a chair with a rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means. So, I say that I came to poetry late, or rather it came to me. It would have astonished me as an English major at BYU when I first began. Levina, come and join our circle. When I first began even knowing that there was such a thing as a poem, it would have been absolutely incredulous to me to think that I could ever write one, let alone have a group of them published. And so this is sort of a miracle, this book. I'm pleased that my granddaughter, who's just turned 15, it's her illustration on the cover. And that's, to me, as important as any of the poems that I've written. But anyway, this is an opportunity for anyone who wishes to either ask about a poem in this collection or to read a poem of their choosing. Or you don't know these poems necessarily, but if there's a poem, the title of which interests you, you can read it, or you can have someone else read it. Today is our 1 month anniversary.
Two months.
See how time flies when you're thinking about poetry.
Well done.
So Gloria is going to read. And maybe we'll begin by reading a poem in this collection called Salamander. Some of you will remember the Salamander letters. And before that became something that was questioned and then disproved, it was a myth. And poetry depends on myth. And so during that time in which there was the story of the Salamander letters, I wrote this poem. And I wrote it in two voices.
105.
Page 105. I wrote it in two voices because I wanted to somehow capture Joseph Smith's frontier country voice as well as the deeper poetic voice that was inside him, which didn't come out until later. So this poem is called Salamander, and it begins with an epigraph from the legend of Francis I of England, I nourish and I extinguish, and from Thomas Brooke, God's people are true salamanders that live in the fire of affliction. So you want me to read this first voice?
Yeah.
When Alvin came back from the hill, he was all in a sweat and trembling. He says he looked in the box and saw a salamander alive in fire, and the fire was in his eyes like small summer suns, and it come out and went into mine, burning like God's own glory, and I was afraid.
And I saw sylphs of flame, archangels of the sun who came to Cumorah, ministering to the night, their salamandering fires illuminating and purifying the darkness.
This was out by the barn, and I said, Alvin, show me the box, because I saw it in a dream full of gold. And so we run all the way up to the hill and was all out of breath. And when we got to the place, Alvin says, look, Joseph, it's right there under that bush. And I looked and saw the fire. And then the bush was burning and the trees was burning and the whole mountain was on fire. The river was on fire too. Flames all over the water joining and crossing one another. But none of it was burned.
And I saw them standing in the fiery heat like the furnace of noonday, white as lightning. And beside them was another, like the heart of the sun, blazing with holiness and light. And the fire didn't harm their hair, nor singe their sleeves.
Then Alvin was taken sick with a bilious colic and burning with a fever and said many strange things, some of them wonderful. And then he held me by the hand real strong and tight and said, Joseph, get the plates, whatever you do, get the plates. And I said, Alvin, don't go, don't go. And then he was gone, his eyes still ablaze, so Father put his hands on them and closed the lids.
I saw him stand in the realms of glory, his whole body white and luminous as the stones in the box. I saw Adam and Abraham and Alvin with them, and I saw the transcendent beauty of the gate through which they entered, and it was like circling flames of fire and the blazing throne of God ascending into light.
And then it was dark, and I didn't dream. And then it was dark, and I didn't dream for a long time. And I said, Mother, the plates, and she just looked at me and didn't say a word. And I turned to Father, but he wouldn't talk neither. When I looked at him, he just shook his head and tears come in his eyes. All summer we worked the fields, and when fall come, we brought in the harvest. But always I was thinking of what Alvin said about the plates. In the night I couldn't sleep, and when the new moon come, I began dreaming again. And then one night an old spirit came to me three times and said, dig up the gold. I woke in a sweat, and it was still dark. I got out of bed real careful so as not to wake Hiram. I put some of Mother's cornbread in my pocket and took Father's shovel and went up to the hill to find the plates. I heard an owl way off in the trees and was scared to go on because it might mean bad luck for me. But the words of the spirit kept haunting me, so I went on. When I found the bush that before was burning, I put the shovel in and dug till I struck a stone box. When I took off the lid, light come bursting out, and I saw the white salamander, and then it was gone. But the old spirit was there, and he touched me three times, once on the eyes, and once on the ears, and once on the lips, and his fingers was like fire.
And I saw that everything was on fire. Eyes and images seen by the eyes were on fire. Ears and sounds heard by the ears were on fire. Lips and tongues and voices that came out of them were on fire. And the word itself was a fire within a fire. Everything burning, burning, consumed by fire and born again.
When I reached down to pick up the plates, the Spirit struck me three times again, just like before, and he said, "Bring your brother Alvin." And I said, "How can I bring him? His bones are buried in the ground." He said again, "Bring your brother Alvin." And I said, should I bring his remains? But the Spirit didn't answer me.
I saw a valley full of bones, dry and white, and a wind from the north and from the night blew on the bones, and they were cold. And a wind from the south and from the sun blew on the bones, kindling the fire shut up in them. And the fire became the word out of the mouth of the prophet, and it consumed all who heard it. But the bones danced to life and rose like flames into the air, burning and turning like a great firebird circling.
When I reached into the box and touched the plates, a shock went through me like a sword of fire, almost melting my bones' marrow. It was so hot, and I cried in agony of soul, "Why cannot I take them?" And the Spirit said, "You have not kept the commandments. You have given in to temptations. Get up and see the signs in the heavens and learn from the mouth of God."
And I looked and saw the heavens like an endless sea of light, the sun, a glorious luminary of the skies, and also the moon rolling in majesty through the heavens, and also the stars shining in their courses. And then all around me, darkness grew into trees whose black branches shut out the light, and I was left alone in the very heart and soul of darkness. And the branches were burning around me, and their flames, black as night, began to burn my flesh.
And I cried, "Oh God, forgive me. I'm just an ignorant and wicked boy. Why did you let Alvin die? He was the most righteous one. I don't know. I don't know about the sun and the salamander. I can't see. It's so dark. My mind is on fire." And then I saw the fire turn to blood, and I was falling from a high window. As I looked up, the sun fell into blackness, and I cried, "O Lord, my God."
And I heard a voice like pure flame pierce the burning darkness, and it said, "I have chosen you in the furnace of affliction, and I will destroy you with a consuming fire, or I will purify you with a refiner's fire. Your heart must choose. If you will burn away your sins, I will make my words in your mouth fire, that you may warn the nations. I will make your words a flaming sword, that you may slay the black dragon, the fire drake of darkness, and touch the hoard of gold, that it will come alive in your hands to call my people to the endowment of light."
And I woke and was cold and afraid.
Very powerful.
So, anybody who wants to read, as long as this cord is stretched somewhat. Giles?
Do I want to read?
Do you want to say anything more about this?
What part of this? So part of it for me was trying to capture the inner voice of this young 14-year-old boy who is untutored, he's unlettered, but something has happened to him, and something happens to him. And what was it that happened to him is something which we're still talking about. But for him, it was somehow learning to reconcile that outer voice with the inner voice, the deeper voice with the one more on the surface, the innocent voice that is really ignorant. I mean, Joseph Smith felt, I'm just a boy, what do I know? But he becomes a prophet. And in that other voice, which he only hears, and we only hear through that alternate voice in the poem, becomes the dominant voice in the restoration. Excuse me. Anyone who wants to can find a poem in here and either ask someone to read it or read it themselves, or just, you know, ask a question about it.
I'll make it easy. The one that I liked was on page 103, right before that. Was anyone else going to read this? Because if you prefer, I'd be happy to defer.
Well, no. Go ahead, you chose it.
Yes, you did. You chose it first.
All right. Flip a coin or play rock, paper, scissors?
Based on a poem by Robert Frost. I'll take the mic.
Oh.
A poem by Robert Frost, a lovely poem in which he imagines Eve in the Garden of Eden, and she begins to sing and speak, and the birds hear it, and it becomes part of their song. And the poem, in Robert Frost's poem, which is Never Again Would Bird Song Be the Same, it goes like this. He would declare and could himself believe that all the birds there and all the garden round, from having heard the day-long voice of Eve, had added to their own an oversound, her song of meaning but without the voice, undoubtedly an eloquence so soft could only have had an influence on birds as song or laughter carried it aloft. Be that as may be, she was in their song. Moreover, her voice upon their voices had lasted in the woods so long that probably it would never be lost. Never again would bird song be the same. And to do that is why she came.
How dare you try to top that? But we know you're audacious, so. Bird song. Never again would bird's song be the same, and to do that to birds is why she came. The first singer sang as he fashioned feathers and hummed as he shaped tiny throats and tongues of the red-winged blackbird, indigo bunting, scarlet tanager, the meadow lark singing, ringing through the reeds, so that when they flew from his hands and swam in wind, they blazoned to all the garden round their singing, his songs. When he made hers from ready clay, shaping the hollow of her throat, sounding her voice apart from the birds and Adam, he breathed into her the music of stars and spheres, of suns and deep darkness, the sounds of all creation, so they would echo from her and all her daughters a rapture of praise ringing through the world. Not bad.
You, in fact, when you wrote a remembrance of when you were, I think, 7 or 8 and had a paper route, and that you used, in fact, it chokes me up. You used to look in the windows of the houses as you delivered the papers and saw all of the perfect homes with the house looking beautiful, the dishes done, and a mom who obviously had prepared the meal, and you thought, wouldn't it be something if I could have that? And I knew nothing about you then. I've tried to follow you a little bit. I read all your articles, what few that I've read across. But I've shared that story. I always read it. I don't put it in my own words. But I've recited it at about 5 or 6 sacrament meeting talks that I've given. The most recent one, just a few months ago, and I served as a volunteer, a missionary at the Juvenile Detention Center. And there were about 20 boys there from ages 14 to 18. And I shared that story of looking out at the world, seeing other people who had it better and who didn't have to put up with what you had to face. And I think it really, really touched them. You speak very eloquently, and you have a voice about you that is very commanding. And I just want to thank you for sharing that very intimate story of a very sad part of your life, I suspect, and just let you know a whole lot of young boys who don't have much going for them, I think, took some comfort in knowing that, hey, he was there and he survived, and maybe we can too.
What a lovely thing for you to say in that remembrance. Thank you for that. There's a group of poems in this collection called Abandoned. And I had been abandoned 10 times by the time I was 10, and one can... story that you're talking about comes out of that experience, and these poems are about that time. The poems themselves start in page 29, but let me read you just one of those, a poem on page 37, which is called Indigos of Darkness. When I was about 8, my mother, who I later found out had been terribly abused as a child and who was never completely whole, left my brother and my sister and me and just left. And after a certain period of time, then we didn't go to school because we wore, all of our clothes got dirty, and we decided we wore our pajama tops to school, and the kids teased us, we stopped going. And this poem comes out of that experience, Indigos of Darkness, with an epigraph from the wonderful poet Mary Oliver. There isn't a place in this world that doesn't sooner or later drown in the indigos of darkness. When we came home, she wasn't there, and she never came back. We charged food at the store next door, mostly candy and soda pop. When we ran out of clean shirts, we wore pajama tops to school and stayed home when the kids teased us. 70 years later, I remember sleeping in her bed, smelling her absence, cradled in her indentation, holding one another against the bruised blue darkness. What did we do all day? Billy, who was 9, me 7, and Janet 4. For 2 weeks, no one came, then the police. We were put in a home. The court sent for our father, who was in the South Pacific, but it took months for the letters to catch up with him in a Navy hospital in Oceanside. I remember I kept saying, my daddy is in the war, and he's coming to get me, but I wasn't sure he would. I keep wondering, could she have imagined that all of these years later, we would still be waiting.
Second World War.
the great, not the great.
Not yet.
Anyone else want to read a poem? Ask a question about a poem? Yes.
I know I'm just the moderator. I'm the moderator. Okay, I'll own it. 84, page 84 of Forgotten Birds. The title itself stood out to me because I felt like that a lot growing up, like a little forgotten bird. So, do you want to say anything about this poem? Okay. Oh, okay. Oh, for the recording. Okay. Oh, okay. Just straight out like this. Okay. Okay, I'll just project. Sleep is not death, but forgotten birds. David Hoke? How do you say it? The black cassocked crow broods in the eucalyptus where blood red umbellates breathe out the odor of camphor. As the graves grow green and spring missiles, its multitudinous wings, his shadow falls, and further falls over the grasses, over the greening, beyond the growing. Listening to kites, I hear all along the long string, the wind vibrating, its wild hum, a polyrhythm strummed in air. This paper bird, pasted to a thin wooden cross, flies in the sky like a fragile Icarus, kept in air only by the thinnest skein of desire. I'd like to get away from Earth, soar to the sun, hide in the spaces between stars, but always with some thread to find my way home to the labyrinth. The cirrus blooms once, one night only. Its opaline fragrance gossamers the saguaro, prickly pear, and manzanita, then withdraws into a dark tuber to await another blossoming in another year. But every morning, every afternoon, dark fingertipped wings circle the desert sky. Their narrowing gyres the vortex of death. In dreams, I swirl down toward darkness as a pearl-like flower rises higher and higher above me. The day I cut the locusts on Huckleberry Island, my chainsaw spitting thick, sappy sawdust into the heavy air, one tree, bound and tethered by ivy, wouldn't fall. I buoyed it with ropes and cut it in sections, then noticed I had cut a bird's nest in half, the fledgling jay clinging to the severed cup. That night, I dreamed the bird, terror, staccato saw, and our black cat climbing. The next morning, I ran to see the nest. I flew to Christ in fits and starts, yet he held me in the tight fist of his grace. When I fled from his nails, he opened his palm to let me fly. Kited by his fierce love, I soared toward the surgical sun, then swooned into the nest of his cupped right hand. His crown was beryl and bloodstone, his left arm raised to the square.
You're a good reader of poetry, thank you.
Thank you.
This is a free-for-all.
In my dreams, this morning, a vacant sky. eagles, beaver, bark rock, hatchets, chainsaws, double-bladed axes, canker, ring rock, gall rust, laburnum and laurel, eucalyptus, sycamore, persimmon, pomegranate, rosewood, sandalwood, agnosperm, gymnosperm, deciduous and evergreen, green leaves, fronds, branches, boughs, twigs, needles, flowers, sprigs, falling, needle blight, slime flux, oak wilt, tsunami, windstorms, avalanches, brown tail moths, scarlet oak snowflies, the new sprung, new leaf saplings in the Blue Ridge Mountains, seedlings of the Amazon, the aerial rooted banyan, the heavy vine mangrove, the poison pencil tree, tropical teak, mahogany, bacteria, viruses, herbicides, hemlock, scale borer, sandworm, heart rock, and the multiple destructions of war. Even the giant sequoia, its canopy among the stars, the bristlecone pine, the maidenhair ginkgo, its eternal leaves unfolding, and these coastal redwoods, alive since Christ, must fall. Yates' golden bough, Lehi's moon-fruited branches, Buddha's Bodhi tree, the colonial quaking aspen of Uinta Range, and that first perennial at the heart of the garden, its flaming angel, its crimson fruit.
I was aware, writing this poem, it occurred to me that at some point every tree in the world will fall. And that idea of all of those things in the italics that are the enemies of trees, insects and people and all of this, and that the image of the tree, which is the center of the garden, and that central image really interested me, and also the metaphor of the fall of humankind, although as in Latter-day Saint theology, a fortunate fall. Mm-hmm. So thank you.
I will read poems on page 58. Poems after William Carlos Williams. 1. Plums. This gnarled, moss-covered tree, barren for decades, has fruited an abundance of plump purple-black. I picked a handful for you, then ate them on the way home. Otherwise, I would have put them in the fridge and written you a poem about their sweetness and how they are as ripe as love itself.
Carlos Williams has a poem about this. Forgive me, I have eaten the plums that you were saving in the icebox. You were probably saving in the icebox. They were so sweet and so cold.
Something
like that.
Just to say.
This is just to say I ate. Thank you.
2. Cat. Soft as silk slipping from a woman's body, our cat poured her black into my glass to lap the last level of milk. In the beveled panes, her eyes grew large, her nose contracted, and then, as simply, she withdrew and licked the drops of cream from her whiskers.
That's good.
Thank you. Lovely. Lovely reading. That's another poem by William Carlos Williams, in which he likens a poem to a cat just coming into
the fog up by the Golden Gate Bridge, the cat paws in the fog.
Yeah, thank you.
I have a question about one that I wanted to read.
Okay.
Was there somebody in here?
Go ahead, and then we'll add.
Okay. I have a question on 41. Black handkerchief.
statement. So these two poems are together. Black Flower is about a husband having that kind of experience, and Black Handkerchief about a wife. It's kind of a counter to the image we have of the funeral and Mormon ceremony of death and being married for eternity. And I can remember on my mission meeting a woman converting to the gospel, and she almost didn't join because she felt that she was going to have to be married to her first husband for eternity, whom she hated. And so I thought that would be an interesting subject for poems.
Sad Mormon heaven.
This is nobody that I know.
But all those people who are stuck with.
Sure. I mean, we can imagine. Let me just read Blank Handkerchief. Lying on the table, he was as handsome as the day he had taken her to the veil. Now his body was impotent, his anger veiled in death. She saw his nakedness one last time before the high priest dressed the body for burial. After the garments, robe, and sash, the bright leaved apron, and the stiff white cap, she asked the bishop for a few minutes alone with the man she had been sealed to for time and eternity. She did not kiss him as she had intended, but looked one last time on his rigid face, then, slipping the black of his handkerchief from her sleeve, she placed it over his face and quietly closed the casket.
She got the last word.
She got the last word. Gallon,
36. She loved him.
Are we in the mic? No, you can read it. Cold Sweet. This,
no, I took her.
I know she's going to read it.
It's easier to hear.
Pardon?
She wants to read it. Oh, okay.
It's page 36, Cold Sweet. Although she hadn't wanted me born when I was, I suppose she suckled me, holding me against her as mothers do. Perhaps she rocked me, our heartbeats searching for one another. She may have held me against the warm curve of her belly when we slept, breathing as one. And yet there are no memories, except a blue porcelain bowl she hands me to fill with snow after scooping away the coal dust. In the kitchen, we mix sugar and vanilla. She places a spoonful of cold sweet in my mouth. I don't know if she kissed me or touched my cheek, but I remember the smell of vanilla, the taste of cold. So I wanted to read that because we have a newborn in the family who's a week old. And so I was thinking of the holding, and you want to believe that you were held like that. And then it just makes me realize how complicated all of our relationships are with our mothers. And we remember some things and that we wish we didn't. And remember other things that are wonderful when we take the time. Anyway, I just think it's beautiful.
Thank you, Gloria. And I just had our newest grandchild, Hadley, who was 2 pounds, 6 ounces. And I held her in my hands yesterday and just had this recognition of this tiny, vulnerable child and the beauty and the tenderness of it, and those experiences sometimes take me back into poetry and some early experiences.
I must say, I wasn't able to be in there at the same time because only 2 people could be in there at once, and then either the mother or the father was all the time, my son Rudd and his wife Tara. But I saw the pictures my son took. And here is Bob with the most sublime look on his face, holding this child like he wished he'd been held, I can tell. And then next to his heart, and just adoring her. She's now 3 pounds, 12 ounces.
Okay, she just read the
was going to read, but I spotted another one here. Page 31. Pearl Harbor. Those are pearls that were his eyes from the tempest. Beneath these waters, their bones in repose, buried in an instant by bombs and torpedoes. At that moment, in a small Arizona town, my father, fresh from milking, sits down for a late breakfast and listens to the radio. We are too young to understand, but recognize a fear we know from dreams. Later, their voices erupt, strafing the night. She begs him not to go. Soon he sails from San Francisco for islands of death across the Pacific. In the museum, I look up at the small plane suspended from the ceiling and remember the story. A bomber heading straight for my father's small ship at the last moment changes course to hit a nearby destroyer. There is nothing he can do with eternity, or while eternity is suspended in time. My father sees blood and fire on the water, a severed arm, images that no whiskey will wash away. Looking at the placid sea, I bow my head for all that unfolded from that day when I was six and the world twisted on its axis to this. And I might just say, I remember that day. And we were at state conference in the old tabernacle in Ogden. And the meeting progressed. It was the Sunday afternoon session. And even though the attack occurred at 8 a.m., it took that long because of the time differential. And just before he disbanded the meeting at the conclusion, the stake president stood and said, "I have terrible news." And I thought he was going to say the president of the church has died. But he announced the bombing of Pearl Harbor and said, "We're now at war." And all of us just in total dismay. And anyway, that... you had to have been there. That that was quite an event.
Oh, well, you know, I can perch. Oh, we're good. 61, Jean at Wilder Beach. Yes, 61. Is this?
This is in honor of Jean England.
I thought so. Blessed are those who listen when no one is left to speak. Linda Hogan. Were you here, we would talk about the straight seam that divides sea from sky, and how the world is not like that at all. We would talk about these caves, how the one resplendent with ferns seems like a flowering heart, and how the other, which the sea has washed to blackness, is like the mysteries we sometimes explored. We would talk of falling towers and civilizations, and how in dark times we hold poetry in our hearts. But you are not here, and so I listen alone to the sea's soft sibilance, the pelican's cry, the liquid splash of dolphins. An enormous log washed against the back of the cove by winter storm stood tall in the Santa Cruz Mountains, drinking underground rivers and reaching toward the sun. It too speaks through its multitude of markings, curved lines, strange scribblings, deep scars, words of bark and bugs, voices of rivers and seas, the ruined and ruined language of the world.
That's a wonderful reader we have.
think we have time for at least one more.
What time is it?
Remember how time flies.
I was going to read Waiting for Morning, page 39. His winter eyes blank, the thin brush of his mind tumbles in his dreams. Out the window I watch torrents of rain wash the day as lightning divides the night. On the way to the hospital, boxwood and cherry, lilac, sumac, apple, pear, and purple blue morning glories climbing everywhere, all the trees, vines, and bushes expanding, exploding into light. Unsure of this place, my father opens his eyes, speaks my name, then slips back into Leith's stream. Each spring, Christ calls all the world's flowers and wild weeds, calls rivers and rivulets from hills, bees and butterflies from blossoms. Some morning, my father will come, shouldering through earth, rising through new grass, strong as trees, growing into the sun.
I want to close by reading a poem which is not in this anthology. One that I've written recently. I've written two poems on this subject, one which will appear in the next edition of Orientum, which is coming back into press, the Journal of Mormon writing. And that poem is called The Last Gift of Grace. And in that poem, which is really based on a conversation I had with Carolyn Pearson, in which she imagines our Heavenly Mother coming to the celestial kingdom where the other gods don't come. And so I thought that's a very interesting idea. So that was poem is called A Final Gift of Grace, in which I imagine that our Heavenly Mother comes down to that kingdom and teaches us all to write poetry and sing songs. And this poem is called, I can bring it up here, Poetry in the Kingdoms of Light. And it begins with an epigraph, a wonderful epigraph from a poem by Linda Gregg called Fishing in the Keep of Silence. God, who thinks about poetry all the time, breathes happily as he repeats to himself, there are fish in the net, lots of fish in the net of time of the heart, lots of fish this time in the net of the heart. And then this is my poem. Because he thinks about poetry all the time, and writes it whenever he can. God, who imagined everything before he sang it into light, said to the angels, in that kingdom of stars I will come with words and wonders, visit them in rhymes and rhythms, in song and sounds, which they will catch in the nets of their hearts and sing back to all creation. To those in the kingdom of moons, I will send stars and suns, sonnets and stanzas, so that they too may send music spinning into space and echoing among nebulae. To those in the kingdom of suns who sang my beauty and glory in a world fallen into night, I will send luminous moons and stars, golden galaxies and supernova, so that the poetry of all my kingdoms, the music of all my spheres, will reach even to outer darkness, into the black holes of memory, where it will ring and resound even in the dark, deaf ears of perdition. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you once again to Bob Reese, and thank you all for being here. We do have another session starting at 5 p.m. in this room. It is the Gifts of a Faith Crisis is what it's called. So we do need to clear out of here. But again, Bob is selling his Waiting for Morning, and I believe he's offering it for $10. So if you would like it.